Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 37. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. As always, a huge thank you to the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so very grateful for each and every one of you. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before the end of June, and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. June's prize is a copy of Owen, Book 1 of the Tudor Trilogy by Tony Riches. Huge thank you to Tony for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Check out his other great books at tonyriches.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm delighted that joining me on the show to talk all things Anne of Cleves is Heather Darcy. Heather works as an attorney in the USA. Along with her Juris Doctorate, she has a BA in German. She's currently studying for her Master's in Early Modern History through Northern Illinois University. Heather runs the website maidensandmanuscripts.com and is the author of Anna, Duchess of Cleves, the King's Beloved Sister. My conversation with Heather straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Heather. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited to be chatting with you. Now, I'd love it if we can start by you just telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, so I have the Bachelor of Arts in German Languages and Literatures. I actually started studying German when I was 15. I'm 34 now, so I'm coming up on 20 years of being a German speaker. And then I wound up going to law school, and I have a Juris Doctorate in American Jurisprudence, and I am an active practicing attorney. That's what I do during the day. And right now I am studying to get a Master of Arts in Early Modern History, and I'm focusing on the Holy Roman Empire under Charles V. And so that would be pretty much the same time period that Anne of Cleves and Henry VIII were alive.
That's right. Yes, fantastic. And so what specifically sparked your interest in Tudor history?
Well, going way back when I think I was probably about 12, but it was in middle school, we had to pick a biography about someone who we found inspiring. And I actually picked Elizabeth I. And so that's probably the first time I was really introduced to Tudor history, I suppose. And I think I really started to get into kind of the, not so much the direct Tudor history, but maybe the Tudor adjacent history, if you will, within the last probably 8 to 10 years now.
Right. Okay. Fantastic. Now, you've written an excellent biography of Anne of Cleves, or Anna, as you call her in the book. What drew you to her story?
I just felt like there was more to her than just being kind of a plain woman who was ignorant and out of her element and unattractive. I figured, especially because she was 24 by the time she moved to England, she had obviously lived quite a bit of her life in Germany, especially for how early people died in that time period. And so I just wanted to find out if there was more. And also, she's constantly called Anne of Cleves.
Yes.
And I figured that probably wasn't her birth name because she's German. And that's just it's not a very common name in Germany, right. I would say, from what I know. So, but yeah, I just wanted to find out more about her and see if there's anything else going on besides her being ugly and getting dumped.
Exactly. Yeah, there must be more to the story. Could you tell us a little bit about Anne's family and the religious and political landscape into which she was born and raised?
Yeah, so her family was very well connected, especially on her mother's side. Her maternal grandmother was Sibylla of Brandenburg, so she was related to the electors of Brandenburg or Brandenburg, if you prefer. Mm-hmm. And she was also, her family's territories were kind of in the middle of the Holy Roman Empire, so it was a very strategically important area to govern. Mm-hmm. And also, her paternal grandfather had had several illegitimate children. He was actually known as the child maker, and I think he had over 60 illegitimate children. So they had a lot of family members running around. I think her dad was one of three legitimate children, so she had an uncle and an aunt on her dad's side. And then, of course, her mother, Maria, was just an only child, though Maria likely did have an illegitimate half-brother named Johann of Jülich.
Right. Okay.
And religiously speaking, they were certainly Catholic. There's no doubt about that. I don't think that anyone really became Protestant until Sibylla, the older sister, married Johann Friedrich, the Elector of Saxony. Mm-hmm. And even then, that took a little bit of time. Anna's mother was certainly Catholic. Her father kind of upheld Catholicism, and I'm not going to give away a whole lot because there's a big part of it, or excuse me, there's a lot more information in the book about it, but
yes.
I would say that she was definitely raised Catholic, and she was at a Catholic court, and I will let the reader decide what the religious leanings were of her brother. Is that fair?
That's fair. All right, so we know quite a lot about the education that Catherine of Aragon, for example, and Anne Boleyn received. However, we don't often hear very much about how Anne was brought up and educated. You've mentioned it was a fairly Catholic, you know, conservative court. Could you talk to us about her formative years and the kind of learning, I suppose, that was valued at her parents' court?
Absolutely. So we don't have a lot of records at all about Anna's childhood or about her sisters, but generally speaking, noble German women were raised in what's called a Frauenzimmer, which means women's chambers or women's rooms. And so it was kind of like a court that was separate from the men's court. So you do see this a bit in England, like Catherine of Aragon or Anne Boleyn or really any of the queens had their own mini court kind of separate from King Henry. So in a noble family's court in Germany or in the Germanic territories, you'd have the Frauenzimmer, which the women would be raised in. Spend their time in. They'd learn really practical skills like sewing. I've heard that they've learned weaving, but I can't confirm that. But sewing, embroidery, mending clothes, how to cook, how to manage a household. So I imagine that would include, you know, basic mathematic or accounting skills, or just generally how to kind of keep things together in case the husband is away taking care of business somewhere else or at war or something along those lines. They did have some dancing. It just wasn't very excessive. So of course, if there were visiting dignitaries or something like that, the women would come out of the Frauenzimmer, but there was usually a governess around. Anna and her sisters were educated around her mother. So like her mother would have been present in the Frauenzimmer and kind of keeping an eye on them. They would have been exposed to women who were pregnant. They may have even witnessed childbirth, depending on what was going on, but it was not uncommon for a woman to give birth in the Frauenzimmer because you're already surrounded by other women. And there's actually, I found a couple manuals about being a midwife in the Frauenzimmer and assisting a woman give birth. So it wouldn't surprise me if Anna and her sisters already had an idea of how the birds and the bees worked by the time they were teenagers.
Right. Okay, yeah. And that's important, actually, for an episode that comes later in Anne's life, definitely. All right, so talk to us about the marriage negotiations. How did they come about, and why was an Anglo-Cleves alliance appealing to Henry and to Thomas Cromwell, for that matter?
Well, of course, Henry was looking for a bride.
Yes.
No one in France was really keen on it. What was nice or attractive about Anna's family is that her brother-in-law was the Elector of Saxony, Johann Friedrich, and he is a very, very powerful person. So I think that usually people, when they think of the major powers during that time period, they think of England, France, and Spain / the Holy Roman Empire. And while that's certainly true, I also think that within the Holy Roman Empire, you have Saxony. And so by marrying Anna, then Henry would be able to possibly control the emperor, geographically speaking, or at least have military access through the United Duchies, which is where Anna's family is from, and then also from Saxony, which is a little bit farther to the east. Also, he'd be sandwiching France to an extent between the United Duchies and England. If he ever needed aid in the Low Countries, let's say there's something going on with some sort of issues with trading, or if Charles V or Francis was trying to block the ports that England used to conduct commerce with the Netherlands, Anna's family was there to assist with it. I think that's my answer.
Okay. That's a really good answer. I was even taking notes while I was listening to you. All right.
And as far as for Thomas Cromwell, I do think there was a religious element to it.
Okay,
yeah. I will say that I have not studied Thomas Cromwell heavily as a reformer, if you will. I am, of course, aware that that was one of his major goals, or at least that's my understanding. That was one thing that was very important to him, was furthering the Reformation. And while Anna herself may not have been a Catholic, her family was connected with a very, very powerful pro-reform, pro-Lutheran person through the Elector of Saxony.
Absolutely, definitely. So it's hard to talk about Anne of Cleves without addressing that fateful first meeting in Rochester. So what actually happened, Heather, on that day?
Well, that's a good question. I go a little bit more into it in my book, but we have to keep in mind that most of the information that we've relied on about Anna's relationship with Henry, for the past 500 years, were taken at depositions that were private, that were being written down or testified to specifically so that the marriage could be annulled.
Yes.
That was the whole reason for it.
Yeah.
So I found a German account of their first meeting that was written within a couple days of Anna and Henry meeting at Rochester. And the whole thing's different. You get a very different feel for how Henry felt about Anna. And one thing that I found very interesting is there's absolutely no mention of furs. That's the big thing, is that Henry brought her a gift of furs, and that is not mentioned at all in the German source.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And it's a really wonderful point that you make about when those testimonies were taken, because that is so important to keep that context in mind, I think, when we're reading those English sources. Are very important. So did you want to say anything else about that? Or
I would echo that. As far as I can tell from everything I've read about Anna, just as far as secondary sources go and biographies about her where she's mentioned, all of the information really, really heavily relies on those depositions and the attestation that Cromwell signed and the letter that he scrawled out from when he was captured in the Tower, awaiting beheading, basically. And that's what I think we've based our knowledge about Anna and Henry's relationship on for the past 500 years.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So on Tuesday, 6th of January, 1540, Henry married Anne of Cleves. What do we know? Do we know much about the actual ceremony?
I think we have a good idea of what they were wearing. That was recorded. Henry was wearing cloth of gold with black furs, I believe, and had some sort of silver embroidery on the cloth of gold, and had a crimson satin coat on that was embroidered as well. And Anna was wearing a cloth of gold gown, and that I think she had pearls, like embroidered pearls, if that makes sense, on her dress.
Yeah.
And it was in the Dutch fashion. And I think that she had her hair down. So she was reported to have very long blonde hair like her mother Maria had. If in my book, there's actually a picture of a portrait, or excuse me, a mural that was done of her mother and her father, which I'm going to go on a tangent here, I'm sorry. But what's fascinating about those images is they're in Schlossburg or Borg Castle, which was not ever touched by either one of the world wars. We don't have any extant portraits of Anna's parents or her sister Amalia that I'm aware of or that I think have been found yet. And that's probably because the Swan Castle in Cleves, the main ducal seat, was completely destroyed during World War II. So when you look at the images in the book, there's one of her parents, and those murals were completed right around 1900, before either one of the world wars, and they were never touched by either of the world wars. So we have very good likenesses and copies of portraits that probably had been taken from life at some point, and that's what was used as the template for the murals. But so Anna's mother very clearly had kind of like a wheat blonde hair, and Anna was described as wearing her blonde hair down for her wedding. So I'm wondering if it was kind of the same color as her mother's and a little less like her sister Zabila, who kind of had reddish hair. And she was, and I think Anna had a type of tiara, like a coronet on her head that had some stones, and also had rosemary, like a rosemary wreath on her head, and a lot of chains and just jewels in that very thick, heavy kind of German fashion that we see portraits of, especially with, I think you can see though that kind of fashion in the Louvre portrait of her by Hans Holbein the Younger. And then also if you look at any portraits of her sister Zabila from Saxony, you can kind of get a feel for the German fashion of the big heavy chains and the jewels and things like that.
So where did the actual ceremony take place, Heather?
So the actual ceremony took place at Greenwich in the King's Gallery, I believe it was. And it was the Archbishop of Canterbury, Sir Thomas Cranmer, who performed the marriage ceremony.
Okay, great. So let's talk a little bit about Anne's household. So was she permitted any German attendants, or were they all English ladies by this point?
I think she had maybe a handful of German attendants.
Right, okay.
Because there was, I think her governess came over with her, and I don't think she was very keen on her going back. I will say I did not fully dive into the actual structure of her household or who was there, but it was definitely predominantly English women by that time, which I think was fairly common. I think the same thing happened to Catherine of Aragon, where it was almost all English women except for a handful of Spanish ladies that she had brought with her to England.
Yes, yeah, I think that's exactly right. All right, so I'd like to talk a little bit about Thomas Cromwell. Now, we touched on this earlier, but on the 30th of June, 1540, Thomas Cromwell writes a letter to Henry from the Tower. And I think lots of our listeners will probably recognize the last line, which is, "Most gracious prince, I cry for mercy, mercy, mercy." So the following day, there's a bill of attainder passed against Cromwell. Now, by this time, he's been languishing in the Tower of London for nearly 3 weeks. And according to Cromwell's account, and we've kind of already mentioned this, would have been written under quite significant duress, Henry was unattracted to Anne. He was repulsed by her from the first time he met her, and he even made some comments that I suppose suggest the king even wondered about Anne's virginity. These are the reasons that people generally give as to why Henry had his marriage to Anne annulled in such haste, I guess. But in your book, you propose a very different theory, and one that considers Cromwell's account alongside a series of letters written by Thomas Wyatt, who at the time was Henry's ambassador to the Holy Roman Emperor. And Thomas is writing about these growing tensions between Willem, I hope that's how you pronounce it, and Charles V. So given the often conflicting reports, why do you think that Anne's marriage to Henry fell apart so quickly?
I'm not going to completely answer that because it's very well, in my opinion, explained in the book. Of course, my opinion's biased. You have to keep in mind that they were trying to have the marriage to Anna annulled. So they were trying to prove that he never consummated the marriage with her. And so one of the ways that that could be proved is if he was never attracted to her. They were trying to show that she was someone else's wife. So they were trying to base that off the alleged pre-contract that she had to the son of the Duke of Lorraine, amongst other things. So going to Cromwell specifically, he's in the Tower. The secret council have been meeting, trying to sort out how to end the Cleves marriage. You have Norfolk and I think Suffolk come to Thomas Cromwell in the tower and say, hey, this act of attainder was passed against you yesterday, which means you're going to die. Here's this attestation that we need you to sign that talks about these conversations that you had with Henry about his relationship with Anna and about how they didn't get along, how he thought that she was someone else's wife and how he wasn't attracted to her and so on and so forth. Sign here. And then he does. And then after that, there's a letter that he wrote that pretty much echoes the attestation, which he did not write the attestation. That was a document that was brought to him to sign. But his letter echoes the attestation, and it's the one that ends with the most gracious prince, I cry for mercy, mercy, mercy. So what do you think he was trying to do by writing that letter and signing that attestation right after he finds out about the act of attainder?
Yeah,
probably trying not to get dead.
Yeah.
And then as far as what was going on with Wilhelm and Charles V, that I think that Wilhelm did not openly deal with Henry very well.
Right.
And maybe had hidden some things from him, and Thomas Cromwell did not adequately sort that out. I think Wilhelm kind of snuck in under the emperor's nose when he was absent for a time. And by the time the emperor kind of came back around, the marriage negotiations between Anna and Henry were too far gone.
Yeah. So really important to obviously look at both accounts when we're trying to work out what's, you know, what's happened in that period, which you've, I think, done really successfully in your book. And I recommend people go there for more details, definitely. So, but we know that in the end, Henry gets his annulment, of course. You mentioned the secret council. Can you just maybe tease that out a little bit more? What role did they play in this?
The secret council had to come up with how to annul the marriage, because you don't want a divorce, because that would create some other problem. You needed the marriage to end as quickly as possible, as quietly as possible, and as legally as possible. And so that was really what the secret council was there to do, and also to figure out who are we going to have testify to all these different facts to support that Henry never consummated the marriage and that Anna was married to someone else and so on and so forth. And so Anna didn't have anyone present on her behalf at the convocation, which is what took place after the secret council got done with their meetings. And that's where all the evidence was kind of presented to the archbishop and the different legal minds in England, and where they decided, okay, yeah, this isn't a legal marriage, so we need to annul it.
All right. And how did Anne respond when news of the annulment was delivered to her?
She was devastated.
Mm-hmm.
She was absolutely devastated. I think that, if I remember correctly, they kind of, Suffolk and Norfolk kind of blamed her breakdown, her initial breakdown, on the poor translation of what was happening to her, just saying that she didn't quite understand what they were saying. So then they went back, translated it into German, I believe in letter forms, that she could read it in her native language. And I'm sure by that time she had enough time to kind of compose herself, but she was not happy about it. I mean, she trusted Henry. She trusted him quite a bit. She had no reason to think that her marriage wasn't lawful. But here she is, a woman in a foreign country, and no one there to protect her. So,
yeah, she was in, and obviously at that time, perhaps she'd picked up a little English, but obviously, as you've said, you know, she was obviously not comfortable enough to be having full discussions without a translator at that point.
Yeah, well, I think that she, I guess to kind of touch on that for a bit, there aren't a whole lot of times where we have documentary evidence specifically saying that she required a translator.
Okay.
That is one of the only times that I think she did. So I'm sure that once she found out she was marrying the King of England, they probably tried to teach her some English at some point. She was pretty much fluent within the first 6 months of being in England, so right around when all this is happening. However, what I'm guessing was going on is they wanted to make sure that she understood everything properly. And with this being such an important big deal, if I may, I'm assuming that's part of the reason why they put it into German, so she could fully understand what was going on. But when she first meets with her new court at Greenwich or on the Blackheath, there's no mention of her having translators present there. That doesn't mean that there weren't, but I'm sure she could at least make small talk with her ladies by the time she set foot in England. And she had those 3 weeks in Calais to speak with the different people and officers that were present there and waiting on her while she was waiting to cross the channel. So I don't know that there's any reason to think that she couldn't conduct herself in English pretty well by the time the secret council and the convocation and the annulment happened. I just think that it was safer for everybody if there was a translator present to make sure that everyone's messages were getting across correctly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I think also under the stress of the situation and the legal jargon would have probably really necessitated someone there just to make sure, as you say, that she's understanding everything completely. That's great. That's a great point, Heather. So what was Anne's life like post-annulment?
I think it was pretty pleasant. She could kind of come and go as she pleased. She was invited to court often enough. She, and this was mostly during the reign of Henry VIII. I think things got a bit rough during the reign of Edward VI because he just didn't have any reason to care for her. And then when it came time for Mary I's reign, I think she had a good relationship with both Mary and Elizabeth. But of course, Mary kind of had a tumultuous few years on the throne, and Mary became displeased with Anna at some point, and then Anna kind of just faded into the background for the last couple years of her life. But Anna, I would say, stayed friends with Henry. One thing I'd like to address is there's often that rumor that she had a baby with him. I think it was, what, late 1541 to early 1542. And where that comes from is she had taken ill. So she may have died from stomach cancer. We don't really know, but it's possible that she had something like that, or she just had some sort of declining illness that was in her stomach. So she would take to her bed a lot. And she had taken to her bed in late 1541 to early 1542. And one of her ladies brought in the lady's infant son to show to Anna once she was feeling better to kind of help cheer her up a bit. And it was from there that we got the rumor that Anna had a baby with Henry. But you have to keep in mind that, first of all, Henry visited Anna at Richmond in August of 1541. And that's when he was still really, really in love with Catherine Howard, because Catherine Howard's fall didn't happen until like late October, early November of 1541. And if Anna would have become pregnant in August of 1541, then the baby would have been extraordinarily premature, even for modern times, if it would have been born in late 1541 to early 1542. So
I'm so glad that you, thanks for addressing that, because, that's one that kind of drives me a little crazy every time I read it.
Yeah, and I will say, off the top of my head, I'm pretty sure it was 1541 to 1542. That's when it was. So the other thing I wanted to comment on is there was a brief moment where the idea of Anna and Henry remarrying was being bandied about. And so that was another reason why there was this rumor that Anna had a son with Henry. So someone saw her holding the infant baby, rumor spread, and there you have it. So
right, there you go. All right. So when reading about Anne, you inevitably come across and I quote unquote Flanders mare appellation and claims of how Anne was unattractive, smelly, unfashionable, you know, naive to the point of being quite ignorant, all those sorts of things. So could you talk to us about the woman that you discovered in your research? What was she really like, and what did her contemporaries think of her?
She was regarded as very beautiful in Germany. Her sister was also considered to be very beautiful. I don't know that one was considered to be more attractive than the other, but I also managed to find the Rosenbach portrait of her, which I think could have been executed by Barthel Breuin the Elder or someone in his circle, and that's the image that we're seeing on the book cover. I think that when we look at the facial structure in that portrait and the Louvre portrait, you can see that it's the same person, along with her wearing the exact same blouse in the Louvre portrait by Hans Holbein, as she's wearing in the Rosenbach one, and there's some similarities between the jewelry and so on and so forth. But she was a pretty woman. She was attractive. She, as far as being smelly, I couldn't really say anything about that because I don't know. But again, Henry, when we go back to those depositions, Henry saying that, or whomever saying that Henry thought she didn't smell good, that is to go towards his inability to not consummate the marriage with her. So I don't know how true that is. And then as far as being naive, the story that people rely on is that at one point one of her ladies basically told her that, hey, you have to actually have sex with Henry. You can't just have, you know, kisses with him and go to sleep. And I think that's where the rumor started and has persisted for centuries, that Anna had no idea how sex worked and how making babies worked and so on and so forth. But we have to keep in mind that, again, that was evidence that was presented for purposes of the annulment. Yes. And so, of course, again, have to prove that the marriage wasn't consummated. But on top of that, let's say that conversation really did happen. Here you have the Queen of England, and you have some woman who's English who's asking, and it's you know, one of her attendants asking about her sex life. That's a bit rude.
It is.
So I think if that conversation really did happen, I think that she was more just trying to say, Well, yeah, Henry kisses me at night and we go to bed. What else do you want from me? So
Yeah, exactly. And I think you made an excellent point earlier when you mentioned the surroundings in which she was raised, and that it's very likely she would have, witnessed childbirths and all those sorts of things. So
yeah.
that doesn't make much sense when you consider her upbringing and then that story. It just seems very, not very factual, I don't think. But all right, well, there have been some articles circulating of late which suggest that Anne may have been involved in a scandal in her early life and given birth to a child. What are your thoughts on this, Heather?
I think it's excellent marketing.
So,
But
in
as
terms of
far as
research, you haven't come across anything that would suggest that this is correct?
no.
No.
And just with how strict the court was, I don't even know how that would happen. And I think that I've skimmed some of the articles, but I think that the general rumor that there is, or publicity, if you will, is that it would happen when Anna's brother was the Duke of Cleves. And we have to keep in mind that Anna's brother didn't become the Duke of Cleves until February of 1539. Anna started marginally being considered as a bride for Henry in 1538. And of course, the marriage negotiations were completed by the fall of 1539. So there just wouldn't have been time. And I don't know why her family would put her in that sort of danger either. And again, just with how strict court life was for women, I mean, there couldn't even be boys over the age of 12 in servicing or working in the Frauenzimmer. And all the men had to be out of there at night unless there was a doctor and there was an emergency. Then, of course, the doctor could come in. But she wouldn't have been able to interact with men of court without having a governess around. So I won't say it's impossible because anything is possible, but yep,
Highly
it is
unlikely
great publicity.
in your opinion.
Great publicity. I would be happy to change my tune if I could see some primary sources.
Yes, absolutely.
But
I know, and that's
see.
exactly what we want to do. We want to make sure we're, basing our what we say on actual primary
Sure.
sources and contemporary evidence. And you've done a great amount of myth busting. I have to thank you for that. I think there's a lot of things that you've really cleared up and clarified. And I really enjoyed reading your book for exactly that reason, that I think even after, 20 years of reading about the Tudors, I read your book and thought, oh, wow, this is something new. So, congratulations on such a wonderful, wonderful
Thank you.
achievement. Yeah, it's fantastic. Now, we are up to that time of the show where we play our little game of 10 to go. So, are you ready, Heather?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. What was the last film you watched?
I just watched Brightburn, and I
Oh.
do not recommend it.
I haven't even heard of it. I'm terrible with these things. Brightburn,
You
what's
know, I
that?
don't know if it had international release, but so it's
Ah.
kind of like a Superman story, but it's if
Oh.
Superman were evil. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, so don't watch Brightburn if you're listening.
I watched it, but
Man, all good. So, what was a favorite childhood book of yours?
I was really into the American Girl series, and my
Oh.
favorite girl was Felicity. So she was alive during the American colonial period, and I think her books take place from 1774 to 1776, and that I read those all the time. So it's actually six books, but they're pretty short, but read those all the time, and my parents got me the doll. It was very exciting.
Oh, that's cute. I know I actually had to, we don't have them here in Sydney, but my daughter somehow found it when she was little and I had to order one from America. And they're not cheap, I'll tell you
Oh, no,
that
they're not. No. That was a very special present for me. I think I was 10 when they got me that doll. So that was, I still
Oh.
have her
Oh,
actually. Right now
lovely.
she's wearing an Elizabethan riding habit, I believe. So I've updated her clothing a little.
That's cool. I like that. So describe your ideal Saturday night.
My ideal Saturday night. I would say spending time with my family. So it's summertime now where I am. So I
Yes.
would say maybe going swimming and then just watching a movie and spending time together. Or if I am by myself, really just reading and writing. And I have three pet parrots and I love them all to death. And they are the best writing buddies. So I'm kind of boring.
No, that sounds nice. I like that. So, what do you do to relax or to unwind?
I like to exercise and I definitely like to read. I'm trying to read a little bit more nonfiction. I just started reading this book. I can't remember the author's name, but it's called The Children of Blood and Bone. My coworkers are really into it, so I started reading that. And it's pretty good. So I'd say just trying to read a little bit more fiction, or yeah, fiction, and staying away from the nonfiction, so I can kind of wind my brain down a little bit better.
Excellent. Now, name a favorite holiday destination.
I always like somewhere with a beach.
Yeah, that sounds nice. Nice and relaxing. It's
So
like
I'd
you're
say
in
the
summer.
Caribbean.
Oh, nice. Yes. All right. Fabulous.
Yeah, I like to go to the Caribbean.
What are two items that are on your bucket list?
There is this church in Austria, and I cannot remember what it's called. And I think it's either by Vienna or Salzburg. I don't remember which one, but it's white and it has a red roof and it's huge and it looks beautiful. So I want to go see that. And I think what would the other thing be on my bucket list? You know, I would really. So my family emigrated from Scotland in 1812, and they took a ship from Southampton, England, to New York City, New
Oh,
York.
yeah.
And I would like to take a ship from New York City, New York to Southampton just to kind of get a very, very small flavor of what it would be like to do that.
Oh, I'd love to do that. That's on my bucket list as well, actually. It sounds really good. If you could go back, and give your teenage self some advice, what would it be?
Just keep at it. You know, I play this game with myself where I always think, would 16-year-old Heather be happy right now? Would 16-year-old Heather be okay with where things are right now? And I think at this point I've kind of aged her to like 25-year-old Heather. But that being said though, I just really tried to I guess kind of think about that just so that I can go back and say, "Hey, don't worry, you have some good things coming to you. Just pull through. You'll be okay." Because we're all I was a mopey teenager, but who wasn't?
Well, exactly.
And to keep studying German, which is really what helped me write this book more than anything, hands down.
Absolutely, our language is so important. So, what's your favorite? Do you have a favorite season? I'm sensing you love summer, but do you have a favorite season?
I like the autumn best,
Oh,
actually.
do
I do like summer, but it gets so where I live in the American Midwest, it gets
Oh.
horrendously humid.
Yeah.
So you can have a day where it's like 34 degrees Celsius or, you know, 95 degrees Fahrenheit, but it's so humid out. We'll have 85 to 90% humidity. You just cannot be outside because it's so dangerous. So you walk outside and the air just hits you and you're sweating.
Gosh.
So to me, our autumn is the nicest because our trees are turning pretty colors and it's kind of smells like fall. The sky in October just turns this gorgeous shade of blue that it really isn't any other time of year. And the temperatures are just really comfortable. So I'd say autumn is absolutely my favorite season.
Oh, beautiful. All right. How do you find inspiration?
I have no idea.
No,
And that's a terrible answer. I have a very,
honest.
very active mind, for better or for worse. So I'm constantly trying to learn something or look something up, and something will spark my interest and I'll write about it. And that's part of the reason why I have my website, maidensandmanuscripts.com. If you go on there, you'll see that while there are kind of grouped themes, it kind of goes all over the place. But that's because, like, for example, I was at a research library last weekend looking at primary sources for the new book that I'm writing.
Okay.
And I got off on this tangent of a 15th century manual written by an English pirate on how to go. I feel like that almost sound like pirate. I'm trying to say pioress, like a head nun lady. That had to do with hawking and fishing and heraldry and things like that. And I just got sucked into it.
Yeah, no.
So
I
as
know
far as
exactly
inspiration
what you
goes, it's
mean. Yeah.
yeah, so I don't know. But definitely if it happened, I would say the first half of the 16th century, I want to know about it.
Exactly. The research black hole, that's what I call it. I fall down there, all the time. Absolutely all the time. Oh, you've mentioned your book. Can you tell us any more about that? We're keeping quiet on the subject.
The new one,
Yes,
so
the new
I will admit that I am slightly neurotic and I don't like to say exactly what I'm working on until it's a lot closer to coming out, but I will definitely say that if you liked this first book about Anna, you will certainly like the second book because you'll learn a bit more about important people in her life.
Oh, okay, that
So,
sounds intriguing.
and I think it's due out right around the summer of 2021, so in a couple years.
All right, we'll have to be patient then. We'll have to wait patiently. And you mentioned your wonderful blog as well, so I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes so everyone can find that because you've got great stuff on there.
Thank
Lucky
you.
last, lucky last, Heather. What qualities do you most value in a friend?
Frankness. One thing I love about my friends or the people that are closest to me is if I am being silly, whether it's I'm going down some sort of just nonsensical research path or generally just doing something that doesn't seem like a good idea, I like people who tell me, "Hey, Heather, maybe you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Because usually I'm pretty good at kind of taking a step back and looking at things and thinking, yeah, that might be a terrible idea. So I would say frankness and then just kindness. Everybody's different. Mm. What else do I like? Respect. I know that sounds silly because, of course, we want our friends to respect us, but I think that there's different levels of respect, and I try to have a high level of respect with my friends, and I hope that my friends have that with me too, just because then that way that supports the frankness, if that makes sense. So yeah, if we're constantly teasing each other and I guess kind of getting maybe even borderline rude with each other, even if it's in a playful way, then when it comes to actually saying, hey, this is a bad idea, or hey, I think you need help with this, it's harder to tell. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. All right. Now, it's our last thing. It's the tutor takeaway. So something for us to check out after the show, website, book, film, anything. Do you have a tutor takeaway for us?
I am finishing up reading Dr. Lauren Mackay's book, yes, Amongst the Wolves of Court, about Thomas and George Boleyn. I think it's quite good. It is... Yeah. It is a dense book, but it is quite good. And I was fascinated to learn as much as I did about Thomas and George Boleyn.
Yeah. And I can, I recommend it as well. And I spoke to Lauren about her book on an earlier episode. And I think, that's another really great myth busting sort of book where you come out just going, oh, okay. So he's a completely different, in particular, Thomas, I think. Thomas Boleyn, you just find out a whole different side to him. So I think that's great. So that's a fantastic takeaway. Yeah, absolutely. And I'll put a little link
to that. Well, especially because, and I feel like a lot of the knowledge that people have right now kind of comes from the show The Tudors, which was a very good show for the most part. But there were a few things like the treatment of Thomas Boleyn and a couple other important historical figures that just totally like leave out all the good things they actually did too. So...
Yeah, no, I agree. And I've got no issue with fiction, no issue with, shows. But I think when we want the facts and the truth, we have to go back to the primary sources or, start with really great biographies.
Absolutely.
Like Lauren's and then do our own little bit of research, which is always fun. And you can fall down those research black holes. Heather, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time out to chat and talk tutors.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.